Welcome to Encore, brought to you each week by BoomersWork.com. Hello, I'm Costas Halavrezos. Canadians are preparing to welcome 10,000 Syrian refugees this month and a total of 25,000 by spring. But if you were one of those people, driven from your home by a war with no end in sight, then living with uncertainty for the past few years in a refugee camp in Turkey or Jordan, or a shanty town in Lebanon, what would this place called Canada represent for you, for your family? Reverend Russell Day of St. Andrew's United Church in Halifax recently spent a month in Lebanon and a week in Turkey observing the situation of refugees and trying to understand their hopes and expectations. His church is one of many groups in the Maritimes and across Canada preparing to welcome these refugee families. Reverend Day joins us now on Encore. Hello, Reverend Day.
Hi, Costas.
What was it that made you decide you needed to get a first-hand look at conditions facing Syrian refugees in Lebanon and Turkey?
Well, I had lived in South Africa and in the South Pacific during times of transition and difficulty. And I knew that Canadians trying to help from the other side of the world without local knowledge sometimes don't make the best decisions. So I decided, when I could see it coming on the horizon, that my church would probably sponsor a refugee family or do something similar, I decided to head over and try to get some local knowledge.
Now, could you describe the conditions that you saw during your visits to those camps, some of those first impressions?
Well, there's a wide range. The camps in Lebanon are rougher and in worse shape than camps in Jordan and Turkey, I understand, because the Lebanese government is not letting the UNHCR set up camps there the way they are in other countries.
This is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Right. And so I visited camps that, you know, were pretty rough. People were living in shelters made out of tarps and wooden poles in places that may now have snow, that certainly will sometime this winter. And, you know, they'll essentially be in the equivalent of a leaky tent. Some of the camps had water. They had clean water. Some of them had decent roads for transportation, and the conditions were relatively sanitary. Others were in much worse shape. Open sewage running in the ditches, no clean water, even rougher shelters, sometimes made out of burlap bags sewn together. And one would presume not much being provided in terms of primary health care or food or other kinds of support.
And what about the situation in Turkey?
I didn't visit any camps in Turkey. The camps in Turkey are more in the east. I was in Istanbul and Izmir and those cities and communities on the coast from which Syrian refugees are trying to cross the Aegean Sea on those little wooden, those little rubber boats where so many of them are drowning. And there the refugees aren't in camps. They're not being supported, really. They're just flooding into the coastal cities trying to find a way across, and many of them living in the streets.
Now, why just those makeshift camps in Lebanon and nothing formal? As you say, Lebanon isn't allowing the UNHCR to establish camps there.
Well, I do not know for sure why Lebanon's not doing it, but everybody's assumption is that the government of Syria, the Assad government, would have trouble with this and has been exerting pressure upon Lebanon to not let the UNHCR do the same job. The other factor is that Lebanon is a country of maybe 4.5 million residents, and they've got probably 1.5 million refugees, maybe more. So the capacity to respond to such great numbers is not enough. It's the numbers are just so overwhelming that agencies, including government agencies and other NGOs, can't keep up. Well, I would tell you, Costas, that in Lebanon, it appears that more than half of the refugees are not in camps. They're in communities. So they're piled into suburbs of Beirut, like Bor Jamoud, or they're piled into cities along the border or towns along the border like Minyara or the border towns in the Baka Valley. Some of them are living in garages. Some of them are living piled, you know, 12, 15 people into a two or even a one-room apartment. And some of them are living on the street.
are there any tensions that you heard of among the Lebanese families who might have welcomed these Syrian refugees at first, but now that as time marches on, are having second thoughts about that long-term relationship?
I'm sure you hear about struggles in that regard. You also hear about conflict breaking out in communities like Bourjamut, the one I mentioned, because the refugee numbers are so high and they compete for jobs, they compete for the support of medical agencies and NGOs, they compete for food and other items, so they affect how much things cost, they affect wage levels, they undercut people sometimes in terms of the income they're willing to work for because they're so desperately poor. And so there have been conflicts, sometimes physical conflicts, breaking out between refugees and those who were there before.
Now, as you suggested, a crisis as large as this one has drawn many non-governmental agencies, the NGOs, to help. How are they coping with the huge humanitarian demands of all those people?
Well, the first thing I would say is I was very moved by how hard NGOs are working, how much people in NGOs and in faith communities are sacrificing their own money, their own time, in many instances, their own professional advancement, in some instances, probably taking some risks to support the refugees. So it's just a very moving story of people meeting and trying to support people. The big challenge, or one of the big challenges, is that as the Western countries start to keep their resources home to receive and support refugees, money being sent to support NGOs in the Middle East is drying up. The UNHCR has less money than it did previously for the Middle East. Agencies like CARE International and the Mennonite Central Committee are having to compete with, you know, agencies here that are receiving refugees. And the ironic thing is, if money going east dries up, there'll be less support, and that'll force more refugees to make that perilous journey to the west. So one of the things I've been saying ever since I've come back is we have to be very careful about the way that we support the whole refugee crisis, or we may inadvertently create a situation in which more people have to flee than would otherwise.
And what about the religious affiliations of the people who are in those refugee camps, and I guess in the case of Lebanon, the shanty towns?
Well, you get Lebanon is like a microcosm of the whole Middle East. So whoever's pouring in, will be meeting people of this similar religious affiliation. And one of the things you really have to understand about the Middle East is it's impossible to separate culture and ethnicity and religion. Those lines are very often drawn in the very same places. So, you know, Shia refugees come into Lebanon and they find Shia communities and they tend to migrate there. Christian refugees will do the same, whether they are Assyrians or Syriacs or Maronites or Orthodox. Sunnis, the same thing in broad sweeps, but the Sunnis are such a disproportionately high percentage of the refugees that they can't all find, cousins or fellows to receive them, and they end up making up a big part of the people in camps.
You're listening to Encore, sponsored by BoomersWork.com. I'm Costas Halavrezos. If you're retired and looking for part-time employment, or if you're an employer looking for experienced men and women, BoomersWork.com can connect you. Just go to the homepage of BoomersWork.com. My guest on this week's edition of Encore is Reverend Russell Day of Halifax. He recently returned from Lebanon and Turkey, where he got a first-hand look at the conditions under which Syrian refugees are living. Reverend Day, what advice would you have for the communities and individuals waiting to welcome the refugees here in Canada, but who still have questions for the federal government?
Well, I would say get yourself educated. There are plenty of agencies like ISANS in Nova Scotia that can do a really good job of educating people. I would say do some research into the best way to help. Don't just assume that sponsoring a refugee yourself or having your church sponsor a refugee is the best way to go. There may be other ways you can help. If there's a person or a group that can't raise $30,000 to sponsor a refugee, you certainly can, with $1,000, $2,000, $5,000, make a big difference in what happens to refugees by sending the money to an NGO or to an agency working in the Middle East. And then the other piece of advice I would have is become educated about the culture and the religion of the majority of refugees who are going to come, which is Islam. I find there is a big gap between the number of Muslims arriving in our culture and the knowledge of Islam and of Arab culture amongst the people receiving them. And if we let the 6 o'clock news or talk radio shape our impressions of Islam or of Muslims, it's going to be skewed. So it's really important to become educated about that culture, and also just to get out and take opportunities to visit Muslim communities. The Umma Mosque in downtown Halifax, for example, is about to have an open house day. It would be great if a lot of people showed up and just met folks from that mosque and learned a little bit about who they are.
Just specifically, how is your church, St. Andrew's United, preparing for the refugees?
We're going to sponsor a family of refugees. We are going to also try to raise enough money so that at least a third of what we raise, maybe more, goes to support work in the Middle East. And we're working in close cooperation between a group called, in close cooperation with a group called United for One, which is the Muslim organization in which the different mosques are working together to receive and support refugees. So we're making sure we do it in a kind of partnership with our Muslim brothers and sisters.
And just finally, the government, the federal government of Canada, has decided that families will get first priority, and single men will, for the time being at least, will be excluded. What are your thoughts on the reasons given for this kind of ranking system?
If the federal government says single men are a particular demographic and we have to take a longer time to do security checks, so they can't come in the first wave, but they could come in March or April, I wouldn't have a lot of trouble with that. But if the federal government is saying for the foreseeable future, single men are precluded, I think that's unwise. I think it's unwise because it's based on an inaccurate perception of the risk. But I also think it's unwise because if we have a whole lot of single men sitting, especially young single men, sitting in camps in the Middle East, they're primed for radicalization. You know, the groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda do their recruitment primarily among single young men who have no opportunities for the future, who have no mentorship, who aren't getting good education. And I'm afraid we're creating a policy that's going to put men right in that situation.
Reverend Day, thank you very much for speaking with us today, and best of luck.
Okay, thanks for your interest, Costas.
Bye now.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Reverend Russell Day of St. Andrew's United Church in Halifax about his recent trip to Turkey and Lebanon to get a first-hand look at the living conditions of Syrian refugees. You've been listening to Encore, sponsored by BoomersWork.com. If you're retired or approaching retirement and looking for part-time employment, or if you're an employer seeking experienced men and women to work for you, BoomersWork.com can connect you. Just go to the homepage of BoomersWork.com. Each week at this time, BoomersWork.com brings you Encore. We'll introduce you to men and women exploring the opportunities and the challenges of the growing number of Canadians aged 50 and over. I'm Costas Halavrezos. Have a great day.